Now we're holding on page Mem Vav in Sanhedrin Ois Kuf Vav. Still talking about various kinds of magic and superstitious practices and whatnot that the Torah says we're not allowed to do. So Tana Rabbanan Ma'oinim. We learn in a Braisa, so when the Pasuk mentions among the types of magic you're not allowed to do is Ma'oinim. So what does that mean? Reb Shimon Omer, Reb Shimon derives the word Ma'oinim from the word Ayim, the eye. So Reb Shimon Omer Zahamab Shivamin is Schur ala Ayin. Means that the magician takes seven kinds of Zera from different creatures and passes them over his eyes, and somehow that gives him the power to do Kishuv. Yad Ramah says maybe it doesn't mean Zera, maybe it means seven types of actual male organs, whatever. He goes into a little arichos over there. We don't want the shear to be X-rated, so we'll stop here. But yeah. Vacham say also it means it's Meloshen Einayim, but Zeha Oich is a Einayim. Vacham say that Ma'onin refers to somebody who seizes people's eyes, meaning he does tricks that makes it look to people like he's doing wondrous things where he's not actually doing anything. Now, there's an enormous amount of discussion among poskim down to our times. What does this mean as far as magic shows? Does that mean you're not allowed to do magic shows? There are some poskim, in fact, who take a very hard line view of the matter and say, yeah, based on this Gemara, it would be also. Different poskim talk about, first of all, if it's a goyisha magician, there may be more of a heter for it. We talked about before when we learned about Shev Mitzvah and Noyach, whether they're also in kishuf or not, the halacha is they're not. So we don't want them to do actual kishuf in front of our kids, but for them to do sleight of hand might be fine. Rav Moshe talks about it, different other poskim achronim talk about, among other things, that if the magician makes it very clear to people that he's not doing it with any kind of special koichas or whatever, just he makes it very clear that it really is just sleight of hand and misdirection and that sort of thing, then there can be more of a heter for it. In any case, when it comes to, when it comes halach lemaisa, and this is the kind of thing you ask the Rav, what's allowed and what's not allowed. Anyway, Rabbi Akiva says a whole different definition of ma'onin. He derives it from the word oino, which means times. So Rabbi Akiva Oimer zamachashiv itim b'shoyes. This refers to a person who calculates different times and different periods and different times, which ones are lucky and which ones are unlucky. For example, Oimer, he says, hayom yofa lotzis, today is a good day to go out on a trip. Lamacha yofa likach, tomorrow is a good day to buy something. It's an auspicious day. It's a lucky day. Or for example, people say, limudei arvishvi es chitin yofas. It's customary. It's often the case that we often find that the year before Shmita year, the wheat is of extra good quality. Now, the Torah promises in Parshas Bahar that if you keep Shmita, then Eivishter will give you a bracha in the crops. But first of all, it doesn't say anything about wheat and then never let alone it being better quality, just that there'll be more of it. Also, only if they keep Shmita. So therefore, this person says that we find as a superstitious thing, we find that wheat is better quality that year than that would be an example of Ma'onin, Rabbi Akiva says. Another example, people say, Ikuri kitnius mi yois rois. If you uproot kitnius, various kinds of beans and peas and things like that, instead of harvesting them, you pull them out of the ground, mi yois rois, that prevents them from going bad and spoiling. That's how Rashi explains. Yad Ramah points out that it doesn't seem to have anything to do with time, so he has a different explanation along the lines of that that he says kind of the other way around. It means in a year when people pull out their kidneys rather than harvesting them, then the other crops that year are going to be bad. He says also the word miyos may actually be, we may repunctuate it, mehayos, that ikuri kidneys, mehayos, it causes, meloshen hoiva, rois, that other crops go bad. So in any case, then, no, those are all examples, Rabbi Akiva says, of Ma'onin. Now, one thing in this, we'll talk about it in a minute. Turn on our bottom, we learn in a braisa, menachish. Now, what about the Torah also says you're not allowed to do menachish. So what is that? What are some examples of that? Zeho ema pito noflam epiv. For example, a person says, my bread fell out of my mouth, and therefore that's a bad sign, and therefore I better be careful. I might suffer loss or damage today. Or makle noflam yodoy, his walking stick fell out of his hand. Or bnoi kodoloma achorov, or he hears his son calling from behind him, and he considers that a bad omen, it's a bad luck. Odev Kodoloi, or for example, he was a raven or a crow calling to him, Svihif Sikabaderech, or deer crosses his path. Now, one thing, I suppose, if a deer crosses your path when you're driving, that might indeed be a bad simon, but not because of Nichush. Anyway, nachash min mino. For example, the person is walking along and a snake comes on his right side, or shul mismoilo, or a fox on his left side. So all of those are examples of nichush, which is also. Other examples, for example, a person might say to a tax collector, "Al taschubi, don't start by collecting from me. I consider it bad luck that I should be the first one that has to pay." Or shachrisur, for example, that he says it's in the morning. The tax collector or somebody else comes to collect a debt. He says, "It's the morning. I don't want to start the day with a bad omen like that, like having to pay out money." Rosh Chodesh, same idea. In other words, it's the beginning of the month. It's not an auspicious time. Motzari Shabbos, or it's Motzari Shabbos. It's the beginning of the week. So all of those things would be included in Nichush.
But the opposite is saying, is there a good
time? Ah, so that's different. So there is a lot of discussion about various details in this. One thing is actually, the Rebbe addressed a number of times in Sichas and also in Yechidus with some people, about the fact. It's mentioned in various places that the Rebbeim, starting with the Rebbe, it's brought about the Rebbe Rashab in particular, were careful as far as expenditures of money to not do them on Motzei Shabbos if they could help it. There were always exceptions, tzedakah, for example, but on the whole, they would try not to. So the Rebbe addresses it in a couple of sichas and explains that basically, it really depends why you're saying it. Here in the Gemara, the person is saying because it's unlucky. If you're not actually saying it, and you're just thinking for yourself that it's a simen toiv to do this way and not that way, then it's not. Then there's not really a problem with it. With that said, though, one time to Rabbi Eisenbach, Alav Shalom, the Rebbe told him, if at all possible, if such a thing comes up, try to evade it. Try to make some excuse why you're not doing it on Motzei Shabbos rather than saying that I don't want to do it. Rather than just saying I don't want to do it Motzei Shabbos, find some other excuse so it has less of an appearance of nichush. But yeah, as far as that certain days are good for things, that we find taka in halacha, for example, and there are even things in halacha where we find, for example, that the ein maschilim the beis v'dalad. There's an idea I think it comes from the Zohar that you shouldn't, that other things being equal, you shouldn't start a new project on Mondays or Wednesdays because those are associated in ma'aseh bereishis with certain negative things that Hashem created on those days. The split of the waters on the second day, and the diminishment of the moon, and certain kinds of diseases on the fourth day. So there is such an idea, Alfi Torah, sometimes to have such a thing. But again, not so much to say that it's an unlucky day that would be nichush, but rather to have other considerations in it. Yeah, the Gemara does mention also in Cholin that, for example, a person can do the other way around. This is brought lahalacha. A person can say, for example, ever since I bought this house, or ever since I started this and this, I've been doing very well, Baruch Hashem. That's not nichush, that's just the opposite. That's he's saying that this thing has been a good simon for me. Having a child say a pasuk to you, as we know, like Mordechai did, is also an example of that kind of thing. There is in that connection, the Gemara actually mentions an interesting point. It says that any nachash, which is not any kind of nachash, which seemingly means superstition, like we're saying over here, that's not like the ones of Eliezer, Eved Avraham, and Yonas and Ben Shol, is not a nachash. Now, what does that mean? So with Eliezer, we know he asks that the girl, he asks Hashem, the girl that comes out and gives me to drink and waters my camels will be, I'll know that that's the one that's destined for Yitzchak. And what happens in the end, he gives her the jewelry before he even asks her what family she's from. So that's an example of this kind of nichush, sort of. With Yonason, there's a story in Shmuel Aleph, there was a point when they're battling against the Plishtim, the Jews are very badly outnumbered. Yonason and his arms bearer say, you know what, let's sneak up on the Plishtim, we'll go climb up the hill towards them and see what happens. If they tell us stay there and we're coming down to you, then we'll know that that's a simon, we should stay put. But if they say, come on up and we'll show you a thing or two, then we'll know that it's a sign from Hashem that we're going to be victorious. And sure enough, they come there and the Plishtim, look at the Jews are crawling out of, the Hebrews are crawling out of their holes. Come on up here and we'll show you a thing or two. So Yonason says to the guy, oh, there's our simon. And they go and then decimate the Plishtim. Anyway, so the big question, what does that mean exactly? Kol Nachash, that's not like them. Eliezer Mela is before Matan Torah, but Yonason is after Matan Torah. How are they doing Nichush? So you have a huge machlokas between the Rambam and the Raivad and then different other Rishonim. What does that mean? doesn't mean, at least in the case of Eliezer, fine, you could say it was Nichrush. In the case of Yonason, you can't really say that, especially if you see Hashem helped him. So does it mean, in other words, that those are examples of Nichrush that would be Osir, and then we have to find a way in their cases that it was actually Mutter? Or does it mean, in other words, that's that it means, that the Ravid explains, it means basically you're going to do a Nichrush, it should be something that's very certain, that's very fairly definitive, like these things. Eliezer can really say with quite a lot of confidence that, yeah, if a girl is willing to do all that, give me water and give all my camels who've traveled a long distance water, then you know, a girl like that can only be from Avraham Avinu's family. With Yonason, if the Plishtim are so nervous that they're going to say, you come up to us, they're afraid to come down to us, Yonason can say, then we know that they're already nervous and we have a greater chance of defeating them. So therefore, in other words, there's like a rational basis for it. It's not Nichrush, in other words. But there's quite a bit of discussion about all that. Fine. The Gemara continues, Tanan Rabbanan, Loisin Nachashu, again, when the Pasuk says, Loisin Nachashu, do not do Nichrush, that means, Kigoin Eilor, Menachshim B'chulda, B'Ofis B'Dogim V'Kechavim. This means people who do Nichrush based on these various creatures, a Chulda, a weasel, or some other rodent like that, birds, fish, or the stars. So they look at, for example, they look at astrology to see whether they're going to be successful or different kinds of things. Marsha brings from Ramban on the Pasuk that it means, for example, he observes the flight patterns of the birds or the chirping of the birds and uses that to determine what he should do or what he shouldn't do. One of the things that's brought in connection with this halacha is the problem of nichrush is primarily when you're going to say, I'm not going to do this because of this. For example, like we said, you know, a deer walked in front of me, therefore I'm not going to do this today because I'm not going to be successful. As opposed to when the person doesn't say that, then there's not such a problem. The Gemara continues, Tanan Rabbanan, Machashefa, Machashef, it says in Eyakov, but in the printed Gemara it says Machashefa, you know, so the Pasuk says in Parshas Mishpatim, Machashefa lo sechaya, don't allow a Machashefa, a sorceress, a witch, to live, which means that based in as a mitzvah to put them to death. So Echad Ish v'Echad Ish. Now the din applies equally well to men or women who do kishuv. So why does the Pasuk phrase it in the feminine? Because most people who are involved in Kishuv are women. We had before about the 80 witches in the times of Shimon and Shatach. Unfortunately, give a variety of reasons why women would be more attracted to this kind of thing. We have in Pirkei Avos also this coming week. Pirkei Avos, Ma'ben Noshem, Ma'ben Choshavim. A man has a lot of wives and the different ones of them are going to do Kishuv to try to attract their husband's attention. But you have Mephoshim give a variety of reasons. Ion Yaakov mentions over here, we know the Nochosh put a Zuama into Chava, and even though it says that if it was taken away from the Jewish people by Matan Torah, nevertheless, there's still like more of a remnant by them. Then, you know, Yoda points out, among other things, that there is more Tumah in women after all. They have Tumas Nida and Tumas Yeledes and whatever, and therefore it's more possible for them to be associated with Kishuv. Okay. Amar Rabbi Yechanan, Lama Nichrush Shmon Kshofim. So Rabbi Yechanan says, why? Where do we get this name Kshofim from? For magic and sorcery like that. Shemachishin Pamalya Shamaila. It means that the Kshofim is Machishin Pamalya. It weakens the host of up above. So what does that mean? So Rashi explains, like this, you may have that there was a person who it was decided, Hashem had decided, Min HaShemayim, that a certain person is going to die, and then a Machashif can kill them. So it weakens that. Now, what's going on over here? I mean, the Eibishter runs the world. Kishuv doesn't run the world. So there's quite a lot of explanation. You find already, by the way, you find Yechezkel mentions that kind of point. He says he speaks to Jewish women of his times who were involved in Kishuv, and he accuses them, you're killing people who were supposed to live, and vice versa, you're helping to keep alive people who were supposed to die. So what's going on? The Eibishter runs the world, not these women or whatever. So there's an enormous number of explanations among Mephoshim. The Ramban gives an explanation that the Eibishter created a world, the Derech HaTeva, and he also created, there were overrides in it. After all, there's times when Teva is overridden for a Ness. Well, now, a Machashif is a Machshef or whatever, is able to tap into those overrides and use them for bad purposes. So therefore, Machishin Pamali Shemayla, it weakens the force of Shemayim in the sense Hashem wants there to be a natural order that should function a certain way, and this person is subverting it and causing it to go a different way. The Ran gives an explanation in his drushes that there are malachi chabola in the world. They wish to put them in the world in order to be able to punish people who need punishment. But now that a person who does kishuf taps into them and makes and redirects them to harm people who shouldn't be harmed. And there's various other explanations of what this means. Machishin pamalia shamayla. One thing is the chinuch points out. You notice the expression pamalia shamayla. Pamalia is that's related to the English word family. So it means like the host. It means like the retinue in Shemayim. So not that it overrides Hashem at what Hashem himself wants to do. Of course not. But it means, in other words, the pamalia shamayla, the malachim, the sorim, the various koyches that the Eved should put in the world. It's machishin. It weakens and overrides them. So that's the problem with it. Okay. Now, the Pasuk says, though, Einoid Milavado. The Pasuk says there's none other than Hashem. So, Amar Abchanan, Afilu B'Dvak Shofin, means even as far as Kishuf. Kishuf has no power in the face of Hashem Zeus, because Hashem is the only one, Rashi explains, who runs the world. Marsha refers over here to an explanation over here. He gives in Chulin, this Gemara is also, this next piece of Gemara is also in Chulin, about Kshofim and about Rav Chanina, and Marsha explains over there. In other words, the vort is, Ein Oid Milavadoi, when Hashem, who is the ultimate Alekim, the ultimate power, decides something, then Kishuf can't override it. On the other hand, when Kishuf, which is also, in a certain sense, Alekim, because Alekim also means powerful ones, when it decides something, then there is an Oid Milavadoi, namely Hashem, who can override it. So the Gemara gives an example. There was a woman who was trying to do kishuf. She was trying to get dirt from under Rav Chanina's feet without him noticing. She wanted to use this dirt for kishuf against him. So Rav Chanina tells her, "Imistayef, listen, if you think it's going to help, zil ovid, go ahead and do your kishuf. Einoid milavadoi." See, the pasuk says einoid milavadoi, and therefore, if Hashem likes me and Hashem appreciates me, then you're not going to be able to do anything against me, says Rashi. And if you do, then it means okay, it came from Hashem, and I'll accept it. Then I'll accept it ba'ava because it came from Hashem. Different Mephoroshim talk about then, based on this whole explanation of Machishin Pamalia Shamayla, is what Rav Chanina is saying only applicable to great tzaddikim, people who are on his level, and ordinary people might indeed be harmed by Kishuf, or is it that no, if a person is taka deserving of some kind of punishment, then the Eivishter can cause it to happen through Kishuf, can happen, that a person does Kishuf against him, and the Eivishter causes it to happen through that. So in fact, the Rabbi Nachman explains when we said Machishin Pamal Yishamayla means to our appearances, to our eyes, it looks like Machishin Pamal Yishamayla, but really it's all being orchestrated by the Eivishter directly. Only if the person deserved punishment would he get it. So according to him, then, when Rabbi Chanina is saying, you know, Milavadi, it doesn't mean it has to be top-level tzaddikim like him. It means any person, as long as he's not chayav for this kind of punishment, then the Eivishter won't allow it to happen to him. There was a famous thing that's brought in this connection. So Gemara says, one second, so the Gemara asks, is that so? Didn't we just say that it can weaken the Pamali Shamayla? And the answer is, Shaini Rav Chanina, Nokish Schusse, it's different, that Rav Chanina has great Schussim, so Rashi says, the Mina Shemayim, they'll give themselves over to save him, even though Kishuf would usually be able to harm him. So again, does that mean, in other words, that an ordinary person, in other words, that Rav Chanina is free of Averis, and therefore he's immune to that? Or does it just mean, not just free of Averis, but he's a very high level tzaddik to the extent that he gets special Siyata Dishmaya for this? No, the Pashtos, this is Rav Chanina, the Talmud of Rebbe, who succeeded him as a Rosh Hashiva. So one of the late Tanoim or the Amiroim. There was a very famous thing brought in that connection that's brought from Rav Chaim Volozhiner. He says that he brings an idea. He says if a person concentrates absolutely and thoroughly on Einoid Milavadoi, then in fact it won't be harmed by anything, by any of the dangers in the world. And it's brought there's a famous story in that connection. You know that the whole family of the Soloveitchiks, the Beis Halevi and Reb Chaim Brisker and that whole dynasty descended from Reb Chaim. And it's brought that when Reb Velvo Brisker and his family were escaping from the Holocaust, he taka used this to save himself and then most of his family over and over again from the Nazis. One particular detail that's brought about that, at one point they hired a driver to take them through some very dangerous areas, and he tells the driver, every time you come to a roadblock, to a checkpoint, tell them your car is empty. And every time when they come to a checkpoint and the soldiers seem to have thought that the car had people in it, and they go and examine, and sure enough they don't see anybody in the car. The Gemara goes on, speaking more of Kishuf, Omer of Aivu Bar Nagri, Omer of Chiyah Ba'aba. Now we have, when it comes to the Mechashvim in the Tachartumim, the Mechashvim in the Tzrayim, it mentions when it comes to them trying to duplicate what Moshe and Aaron did, it uses two different expressions. First you have when Moshe and Aaron come with the signs about the sack turning into a snake and about pouring water on the ground and it turning into blood. So the Chartumim duplicated those. And the Pasuk says that they did them bilotehen. And then later on, it says that they, when it came to Makas Dam and Sfardea, that they duplicated those bilahatehen. So what's the difference? So Omer of Aivu Bar Nagri, Omer of, and then when it came to Kinim, then already they weren't able to duplicate it for reasons that the Gemara is going to explain later on. So Omer of Aivu Bar Nagri, Omer of Chiyah Ba'aba, Delotehem Elumaisa Shading. When it says that they did things Delotehem, that means they accomplished it through Shadim, that they had Shadim do what they're telling them to do. The word Balot, Rashi points out, means in secret, in silence. So therefore it refers to Shadim who are usually hidden from our view. So they're whispering to the Shadim and getting them to do what they want. On the other hand, Velahatehem means that they would do them with Kishuf, not with Shadim, but rather they would do it themselves. Now, according to the Rambam that we talked about yesterday, that Kishuf, all these things, Kishuf and superstition and never have absolutely no actual real-world validity, so then the Rambam would have to explain that they did it all with sleight of hand either way, whether with Shadim or with Kishuf. According to the vast majority of other Rishonim and Achronim, there was actually something that were actually real things that they were able to accomplish over here with their Shadim and Kishuf respectively. Anyway, where do we see Velatayim as Maisak Shofim, V'cheinu Omer, as we have the Pasuk, after Adam and Chava were kicked out of Gan Eden, that Hashem put over there to guard the entrance back into Gan Eden, so they don't come in, the blade of the sword that was turning, it was turning and revolving on its own. So therefore, so it seemed like Shadim. The famous expression in English that says any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. Meaning you see something, you don't understand how it works, then you think that it's magic. So here, you know, we have mice in Bechol-Yah, and we have all kinds of things that move on their own, and we understand it's not on their own, there's a motor in them or whatever, but back then they wouldn't have been familiar with that kind of thing. So they see a sword revolving on its own, then as far as they know, it's being done by Kishuf. But it's not. There's no Shadim involved over there. So the NBC, it's called Lahat. So Lahatehem then refers to something like that, where we do with Kishuf, without the involvement of Shadim. Marsha brings up the Oruch has the Gersa the other way around, that Lotehem is Maisa Kshofim and Lahatehem is Maisa Shadim. The point being, in other words, that this sword revolving and flashing all the time, like you see different colors in it. Like sometimes you spin a disc very fast, for example, you'll see different colors on it. So the same way the sword is revolving so fast, you see different colors, the same way as a shed sometimes looks, has different appearances in different colors. So therefore, according to that, then Lahatehem would refer to Shadim. So the Gemara continues in this connection. Omer Abaya, here's a way you can tell the difference. De kofid amona, when you have a sorcerer who's particular that he has to use a certain kind of keli, and he can't do his magic without that. Rashi gives an example from later in the Masechta, where it talks about Sore Shemen, and you have different kinds of Malachim or Shadim or whatever that are associated with different things. So when that shed, then you know he's doing his magic through a shed. So Rashi gives a couple of examples. For example, you might have something called Sore Boihen, where in order to summon this kind of shed, you need dafka a knife with a black handle. Or Sore Pois, they dafka require a glass cup. So then, when a person is doing magic with that, you know that he's calling on the aid of Shadim. Deloitte Kofid Amona, on the other hand, when you have a sorcerer who doesn't care what keli he uses, then Kshofim, then you know he's doing independent Kshofim. Both of them are also, but in other words, this way, like this, the Gemara points out later on, the Sanhedrin has to be familiar with all the different types of magic. So this is an example where you'll need to know which is which. So in this connection, Omar Abaya, Hilchus Shofim, Hilchus Shabbos. The halachas of magic are like the halachas of Shabbos. In the sense, Yeshmehen Deskila, we know there are certain things a person does on Shabbos. He's Chayav Skila, he does any of the Ovis Malachas, or told us. The Yeshman Potter Aval Osir, and then we have things that are Potter Aval Osir, only Dirabanan, or different other reasons why a person would be Potter from punishment for it. The Yeshman Mutal HaTchila, and then you have somewhat similar things that a person can do on Shabbos that are Mutal HaTchila. So Rashi gives an example over here. For example, we know that there's a malacha of tzod. You're not allowed to trap an animal on Shabbos. But let's say, for example, you have, suppose that a deer wanders into your house, and you didn't realize and you closed the door, then you're allowed to keep the door closed. Even you have a case in Masechta Shabbos where one person sits in front of the door and blocks the door so the deer can't get out, and then somebody else comes and sits in front of the first person, then you have the person is actually able to, if the first person moves, the second person can continue sitting there. He's preventing the deer from coming out. Doesn't matter. When he sat, there was no issue in it, and he's allowed to continue sitting over there. There can even be, for example, he closes his door and he finds a deer inside. He's not obligated to open the door and let it out. The Gemara mentions another example over there that actually brings, let's say a bird flies under a person's clothes, he's allowed to keep it there until after Shabbos, and then he has himself a pet bird. So there are a number of other examples like that where we have something where almost the same activity on Shabbos might be osur d'oraisa, osur d'rabbanan, or 100% mutter. The same way with kishuf, you have a similar kind of distinction. The Maharal points out that Gemara is not just using this as a handy way to remember this point. There's a deep connection between Shabbos and Kishuf, because in the case of Shabbos, Hashem created the world in order that there should be Menucha, and eventually Shabbos v'chaya ha'ilamim. And in the case of Kishuf, we just said before, the Eibishter creates a world with a natural pattern to it, and Kishuf overrides that, which is against Hashem's will, so therefore there really is a connection between Shabbos and Kishuf. So, Ha'oisa Maisa B'Skila, a person who does an actual Maisa of Kishuf is going to be Chayav Skila, as we've been describing. Ha'oisa Zaseinayim, when he does it by sleight of hand and makes it look like he did magic, Potter Aval Osir. What would be Mutala HaTchila, like we learned yesterday, Kedir Rav Chanina for Rav Oshia, like what we learned about Rav Chanina and Rav Oshia, Kol Male Shabza, I will ask you, Behilchus Yitzira, where every Erev Shabbos, they would delve into Hilchus Yetzirah, into Sefer Yetzirah, Umivri Lahu Egla Tilsa, and they would, with the combinations of Hashem's names from there, they would create an Egla Tilsa, a high quality calf, but Achli Lay, and they would eat it for Shabbos. So we see that kind of thing is perfectly mutter, because as Rashi points out, they're not creating anything, they're putting together combinations of Hashem's name, and they're thereby creating a channel through which Hashem himself creates.
Does it say that they shechted it or just uttering?
I don't think it says that they shechted it one way. I don't think it says one way or the other. Although, if I remember correctly, the Parashas Drachim brings an explanation when we know that Yosef was telling on his brothers, and one of them is that they're eating Eivim and Achai. So we talked about a while back that one possibility is that they were arguing over the question of are they considered Bnei Noach or Bnei Yisrael as far as Shechita and as far as the animals stopping moving. But I think there's another explanation that they would create a calf with Sefer Yetzirah, and then they wouldn't have to shecht it. And whereas Yosef held that at least if nothing else, it's Maris Ayin, and they should be, if nothing else, is Maris Ayin, and they should be shechting it. So in Omer Ravashi, so Ravashi says, I'll give you another example. Chazino Leila Avur de Karna, I saw the father of Karna, the Nofitz Vishadi Krichi, the Shiroi Minachire, he would blow his nose very hard, and pieces of cloth would come out of his nostrils. So this was like a magic trick that he did. Now, who was this Karna? We find in a number of places in Shas, we find a Karna who was a chaver of Rav and Shmuel. So he was a Yid, and in fact, a distinguished Talmid Chacham. If it means his father over here, then it would mean, first of all, he's a Yid. Second of all, it would mean this is not Rav Ashi, the one of the composers of the Gemara, because he lived a couple hundred years after Rav and Shmuel. We would have to say, as some people do, that there was an earlier Rav Ashi. According to that, then, what would be? So how is he doing this? So one answer would be that it would have to be the Yad Ramah says in that case, Leislamad Ovad, he must have been doing it just in order to know what is Osir and what is Mutter, which we're going to learn later on, that sort of thing is Mutter. Chacham is the Chachamim are allowed to learn it and are allowed to practice it so that they know what's Osir and what's Mutter. The other possibility, I guess, the other possibility might be that it was a different kind. All right. Going on now to Mishnayos Midos. We are holding Perek Beis Mishnah Gimel. So we learned yesterday about the Har HaBayis. So now we have the wall of the Har HaBayis, 500 by 500 amah. The Mishnah continues, Lifnim minenu, further in than the wall of the Hanabayis, Sorig Gavoya Yud Tfachim, was the Sorig, which was 10 Tfachim tall. Now the Sorig, the word Sorig, comes from a word in Lashon Kodesh, Sorag, which means to knit or to weave. So everybody agrees that it was a fence made out of wooden strips, wooden slats, that were placed in a diagonal weave-like pattern. Almost everything else about it, there's different opinions among Rishonim and Achronim. Gavoya Yud Tvachim, the Mishnah says it was 10 Tvachim tall. So there's a lot of different opinions about it. The Rosh learns that it went only along one side of the Hanabayis, the eastern side, he says. And he explains that the purpose of it was, so according to him, in other words, it would have just gone in a straight line along here. The purpose of it, the Rosh says, is that they should be able to carry in the Hanabayis on Shabbos. Because the wall of the Hanabayis itself is not hukaf l'dira. It wasn't made as a wall for the purpose of living inside, because the wall was built first, and then the buildings inside it, and such a thing is not considered, and for Hilchos Shabbos, you can't carry in such an area if it's larger than a certain size, larger than the Chotzer of the Mishkan, and as we learned previously, the Hanabayis was 50 times the size of the Chotzer of the Mishkan. So he learns they built the Sertig, and that way they were allowed to carry there on Shabbos. But Pashtus also, I guess we could say, since it was made out of wood, they'd have to replace it every so often, and therefore it would always be that it's hukaf l'dira. Different other mafoshim talk about that it surrounded the azores at a distance, and it was there basically for decorative purposes. Another opinion that Avya and some other Rishonim learn that it directly surrounded the chayil, which we're going to learn about next. The chayil was an area 10 amos wide, we're going to learn soon, outside the azara. So according to that, the sorig went directly around that and marked it off from the rest of the Hanabayis. It's also brought that on the Sertig there were plaques, there were signs in Greek and Latin and maybe other various Goyish languages as well, warning Goyim they're not allowed to go past this point. They found one or two of those plaques in archaeological digs over the years, and actually one of the ones they found actually says straight out in Greek, Goyim are not allowed to go past this point, and if they do, they're chayav misa. So there's also different opinions of where was the entrance into the Sertig. Was there only one entrance on the east? Were there entrances opposite each of the gates? Here in this diagram, they depict a gate in the Sertig in front of each gate of the Azara, and the Ezra's Nashim. But was it so? Was it so? Maybe not. Different opinions about that. Continues the Mishnah, Shloishes your process for your boy. There were 13 breaches in it, Shapots and Malchay Yavon, that the Greek kings, the Hellenistic kings, when they conquered the Beis Mikdash before the Nes Hanukkah, then they made 13 breaches in it. One reason is, especially if we say that it was the area beyond which Goyim couldn't go, then they breached and they made holes in it, Bedavka, in order to go against that. If we say especially that there were no entrances opposite the gates, then they would have made the breaches, partially so they can more easily get in and out of the gates. Anyway, Chozer v'Godrum, eventually when the Chashmonoim recaptured the Beis Mikdash, they refenced those in again. V'Godrum k'negdom, Yud Gimel Shtachavoyas, so then they made a takona from then on that there should be 13 vowings. When a person comes to the Beis Mikdash, he should vow 13 times to Hashem. Some of the Foreshim explains it doesn't necessarily mean 13. It means as you go around the Harabayas, you would come to one another. If you only happen to go to this one, you'd only bow over here. You'd only go to this one, you'd bow over here. If you happen to go around the whole Azara, then you'd end up bowing 13 times. Later on in the Perek, we're going to see a different opinion why there were 13. Okay. Next, Lifnim Mimenu Hachel. Further inside than the Sertig was the Chel, Esther Amos, which was 10 Amos wide. Here also you have different opinions. Was it 10 Amos on all sides, or maybe only on one side and the other sides? It was wider. Ushneim Osem Milas Hoyusham. There were 12 steps in the Chel. Each step was, the height of each step was half an amma, and the tread was also half an amma. That way it's more comfortable to walk up. So if there were 12 steps, it means it's 6 amas high, which means that the Ezra's Noshim was 6 amas higher than the rest of the Harabayas. The point of that we'll get to later on. Mephoshim point out, as the Moshe Kazis points out, that since also we're going to learn later on that Ezra's Yisrael was higher than that, and Ezra's Kohenim was higher than that, it would mean that at these points over here, you would have had to have more steps. So when we say 12 steps, it means minimum. There's also discussion, does it mean were the steps all the way around, like it shows in this picture over here, or were they maybe only in the front of the Ezra's Noshim? So a lot of these details, there's different opinions about among different Mephoshim. And in fact, the Mishnah says, Kol ha-mailos shehu yisham, all the staircases in this mikdash were all rum maila chatzi amah v'shocha chatzi amah. Each one, the height of each step was a half amah, and the tread was half an amah. Chutz mishel ulam, with the exception of the steps to the ulam, we're going to learn later on that those had a wider landing between one step and the next. Let's talk about some other, while we're talking about that exception, let's talk about some other rules in the Beis Mikdash and exceptions. Kol ha-psachim, shehu yisham, goven chof amah, v'rochban es amas, all the gateways, all the doorways that were in the Beis Mikdash were 20 amas tall and 10 amas wide, chutz mishel ulam, again with the exception of the ulam, where that one was 20 wide and 40 tall. So it was much larger than the other ones. This is, you have the expression, the Gemara says, for example, Piskli Pesach Kachudish Al-Mahad, you make me an opening. The Eivishta says, a truva, the size of a needle hole, and I'll make for your door as big as an ulam for your truva to come in. Because the ulam door was 40 by 20 amos, so it was the biggest door in the whole Beis Mikdash complex. Also continues the Mishnah, Kol ha-psachim, shehu yisham, hayu lahem dlosos. All the gates and all the doorways had doors in them. Again, chutz mishel ulam, with the exception of the ulam, which only had a paroichas. The other gates had paroichas in too, but what they had is they had gates that would be locked at night, and then when the gates were open during the day, they'd have a paroichas hanging there so that people don't peek into the azara. But the ulam had only a curtain and no doors. Another exception, the Mishnah says, Kol ha-sha'orim, shehu yisham, hayu lahem shakoyfes. All the gateways in the Beis Mikdash all had a lintel. They all had a regular door, has two side posts, the mezuzahs, and a flat lintel on top. Chutz mishel todi, except for shau todi, the gate on the north side of the Har HaBayis that we learned about in Perek Aleph, shehu yisham shtei avonim mutis zu agabi zu. There were two stones leaning one against the other. Some of the Mefarshim explain it means that there were regular mezuzahs, but then there was a peaked top, so it looked like that. Although Mefarshim explain that the whole thing was triangular shaped. Anyway, why? We learned in Perek Aleph that the Shaar Todi was only very rarely, if ever, used. So therefore, they made it in a different shape to stress that point. Another rule. All the gates in the Beis Mikdash were eventually changed to gold. When they first built the Beis Mikdash, when they first built the second Beis Mikdash, they were very poor. They couldn't afford, so they made them out of copper or whatever. But later on, they changed all of them to gold, except for Shal Nikonar, where they left it as copper, because a nest happened with them. The famous story that the Gemara tells, where he's bringing them in a ship from Alexandria, and there was a storm, and the sailors threw one overboard, and they were about to throw the other one, and Nikonar prevented them. And then when they came to the coast of Eretz Yisrael, they found the one they'd thrown overboard came along with the ship, the Derech Nes. So therefore, because of that, they kept them the same material. Some say the reason was because the copper or the brass that they were made out of gleamed like gold, and therefore they didn't need to change them to gold, because as it is, they looked like gold. Josephus, in his description of the Beis Mikdash, says that they were made out of what they call Corinthian bronze, which is some kind of alloy that they had then. We don't know what it is exactly, but it was some kind of alloy of copper and silver and gold, which he and various historians from that period say that sometimes they considered actually more valuable even than gold. So if the gate was covered with that, then of course they didn't need to change it to gold. And the Mishnah continues with another Mishnah Dalit, continues with another rule and exception. All the walls around the Har HaBayis and around the Azaris were all very tall walls. Different Mefarshim talk about how tall, 40 amos or 70 amos or even 100 amos, chutz mikosam mizrachim, with the exception of the eastern wall of the Har HaBayis. Because the Kohen Gadol, when he's going to be burning the Parah Adruma, has to stand near the top of HaMishka, HaRazesim, east of Yerushalayim. Now he has to, when he sprinkles the blood of the Parah Adruma, he has to be able to directly see the door of the Heichel, the door of the Olam. Now, you have this 6 amos of height difference between the Har HaBayis and the Ezras Noshim. Then you have another 7.5 amos here, by the 15 steps over here of the Shir HaMalos. Then you have, later on, we're going to learn that there were 2.5 amos between the Ezras Yisrael and the Ezras Kohenim. And then we're going to have later on that there were 12 steps going up to the Ulam. So once you count up all of those, once you count up all those differences in elevation, you wind up with a difference in elevation of 20 amos. The gates, we said before, were all 20 amos tall. So if the if they didn't make the wall over, if they didn't make the wall over here low, then the Kohen would be blocked from seeing the door of the Heichel, but seeing the door of the Olam, he would be blocked by the wall. So instead they made the wall low enough, and the Mefoshim calculated it could have been a maximum of 6 amos over the gate, and that way he'd have a line of sight to see into the Heichel. The Gemara mentions, actually, the Gemara explains, I think, in Yuma, that actually that's only according to one man to Omar. We're going to have later on Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov, the Tanna of our Mishnah, who holds that there was 2.5 amos of height difference between the Ezra Sisera and the Ezra Kohen. We're going to learn later on a different opinion, that there was only 1 amah height difference, and according to that, then, you would just barely be able to see the bottom of the door of the Ulam without having to make the wall lower, and therefore it's only the Tanna of our Mishnah, Rabbi Elazar ben Yaakov, who holds that it had to be lower. Yom Yom Mashiach Ha'Gola of Gimel Tammuz. So we have the famous question, who's going to build the third Beis HaMikdash? Now we know the Zohar says it's going to be built by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Zohar calls it Binyona DeKudsha Brichu, and Rashi writes the same thing, that it's going to come Min HaShemayim, Mikdash Adnei Koninu Yodecha. On the other hand, we have a Yerushalmi that tells us it's going to be built by the Jewish people, and we have the Rambam says that Mashiach, one of the things that Mashiach has to do to be known as Mashiach Vadai, is Yivne Mikdash B'Mekoymai. Now, the reason for that would seem to be fairly obvious. That Rebbe says, look, the build of this mikdash is mitzvah saseh, and a mitzvah saseh has to be something the Jewish people do, not that Hashem does. So how do we reconcile that? Well, we'll continue in tomorrow's installment, Bez Hashem. Continuing with Hilchos Tzitzis. Simon Chavdala, the schar for wearing tzitzis and the punishment for not. So, now, a person is not chayev to buy a talus with 4 corners to be chayev in tzitzis. If a person is wearing a garment with 4 corners, then he has to put tzitzis on it. So, back in the times of the Gemara, their regular clothing had 4 corners, and therefore they'd put tzitzis on it. Nowadays, a person conceivably could go their whole life without it. Nevertheless, it's proper that every person should be zohar v'zoriz, very careful and very eager to wear a talus with tzitzis the whole day, a talus cotton, so he'll remember the mitzvahs all the time. So it's like, for example, you remind somebody about something, and the other person ties a knot in his belt so he'll remember it. This is, in fact, why we have knots in the tzitzis. 5 knots, connected to Misha Chum Shetera, and 4 kanfei, so that whatever direction you turn, you should remember the mitzvahs. So then the Alter Rebbe continues. Even you have, let's say, a person who is not able to wear tzitzis all day, at least you should be wearing tzitzis during Kriya Shema and Tefillah. One example of that is there are some places, sometimes you have, unfortunately, hospital or residential hospitals where people have to be for a mesh of zman, and for various reasons they don't allow them to have things with strings over there, but nevertheless, at least if they're able to put on tzitzis during Kriya Shema and Tefillah, then they should do so.